Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Dacia Eaton of KSKA, Sean Dugan of the Alaska Dispatch, and Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Sean, let's start with the political news. Senator Lisa McGuire has announced that she's running for lieutenant governor, and Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan has announced he's running for something.
Something. Could be a number of things. Senator McGuire announced that she is going to be running for lieutenant governor. She's the first Republican to officially announce for the job. Interestingly, the current lieutenant governor, Mead Treadwell, is considering a run for something as well, U.S. Senate, but he may also decide to run for lieutenant governor. I found it also interesting that when McGuire announced, she told the Juneau Empire that she thought she might be a good alternative to Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan, saying that he did a good job running the city, but she, quote, said he was polarizing. So it seems like she's setting herself up for a good run. If she was elected, she'd be the second female elected to the position after, of course, Lieutenant Governor Fran Ulmer. It's interesting to say
well,
the least.
Well, there's all kinds of assumptions in here.
Sure.
Musical chairs is really what we're talking about. What's Parnell doing? What is Mead Treadwell doing? And perhaps even what Don Young doing? But as you know, in the case of Mr. Sullivan or Mayor Sullivan, he hasn't filed for a federal office.
No, he's filed with the state. And we looked into this. Even if you're going to file with the FEC, you do not become an official candidate for a federal office until you file with the state. So there's a bunch of different filing periods that come and go, intent to run, things like that. This will all, it's fairly early in the cycle. This will all, come together at some time later.
And if I may, what does this filing allow Mayor Sullivan to do?
It allows him to raise money to explore the possible run, and then when he does decide what he's going to run, he can use that money for his campaign. So it basically is a fundraising mechanism. Now, the Democrats do have one guy in the race. Yesterday, a Palmer teacher, Democrat Bob Williams, filed a letter, too, for lieutenant governor. So lieutenant governor seems to be getting the specific action. Everybody else seems to just be filing for something. There's a lot of potential out there.
Yeah, the top of the ballot's kind of crowded, but is there a possibility that maybe one of the Republicans might take on Don Young?
Always a possibility, especially in the Republican Party that seems to, at least lately, enjoy, or maybe not enjoy is the right word, but seems to have a pretty big division within itself. And you've had Republicans running against Republicans for Senate, governor, lieutenant governor.
Yeah, that's where the real intense action has been in factions within the party. Dacia, the recall of Representative Lindsey Holmes is well underway, and the group seeking to oust the Anchorage representative has achieved one of its goals, reaching a signature threshold that they can now bring to the state officials to move on with their process. Tell us about how that signature process works.
Well, they've been going door-to-door in District 19, the Turnagain area, parts of Spinard, down by Sand Lake, and they've gathered more than the required signatures. They have almost 1,000 signatures now. It's something like, 600-700 in there that they actually need. But they just want to make sure they have extra in case there are problems with any of those signatures. And those are just signatures for the application. So there's no deadline for them to submit that. I mean, they're probably going to do it by the end of June, they say. That's their deadline, self-imposed. And then the next step is, if their application is accepted on the grounds that Lindsey Holmes is unfit for duty because she deceived the public in their eyes by running as a Democrat and then switching to be a Republican.
And presumably a court's going to have something to say about this.
It very well could be decided by a court, but they're still going through this process. Submit the application, then the next thing is they have to gather around 2,000 signatures to actually hold a recall. And that would mean, revote in the district.
Now, I got the impression from your story that the people who are gathering the signatures are happy warriors. They enjoy this sort of activity.
Yeah, I mean, they really feel that this is a loophole in the system, that someone could legally do this. And Lindsey Holmes argues that it is legal and there's nothing wrong with what she did. And they say, down the road, they see it being, there being probably legislation to correct this, they hope. And also, there may be a court battle. And they are happy warriors. They have big recall Lindsey Holmes stickers on the backs of their clipboards. And they say they have people coming up to them, pulling over on the street and saying, please, I've been waiting to sign this because people are so angry in that neighborhood. Of course, Lindsey Holmes says that this was something that happened, a change of her mind over a period of years. And she just, when she really felt it in her heart, she decided to make the change. And that she's leaning more toward, you know, pro-business, pro-growth, pro-development.
I believe the phrase that politicians use is, I evolved.
Yes, she pretty much says she evolved. She also had an appointment to a pretty great committee right after she evolved into a Republican. And she says she was able to score millions of dollars for her district because of that.
So. Now that's from the House committee that writes the budget.
Yes.
Right. Okay, Dermot Cole, an Air Force report makes the case for moving F-16s now stationed at Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks and with their attendant civilian and military staffs and workers, an important part of the economy, moving them to Anchorage. What can you tell us about this latest development in this story that's been going on for, a couple years now?
Yeah, right, Mike. Actually, it really goes back several years to even when Ted Stevens was alive, was the first attempt really to downsize Eielson Air Force Base. The latest action is a release of a draft environmental impact statement that recommends moving the F-16s at Eielson, which are the main purpose for the base at the moment, but moving them to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and basically scaling back Eielson Air Force Base. As you might imagine, there's been a lot of resistance to that and opposition to this idea in the past few years. The local business and political leaders were very unhappy with this draft environmental impact statement, which said that the government will save money by consolidating some of these operations in Anchorage. The idea is that the recommended alternative in the document is to have the jets fly up to Fairbanks for 12 weeks a year for training purposes and then spend the rest of the time at Elmendorf-Richardson.
Dermot, if I may interrupt you, you can't see me. We're sort of two different places, obviously. But according to your reporting, what you've read indicates a pretty significant job loss and fairly specific for Fairbanks, right?
That's right. This would take a large chunk out of the interior Alaska economy, and that's the main reason why people are opposed to it. In fact, most people would even acknowledge that they're this is the thing where it really hits them hard. You're talking about thousands of jobs here, directly and indirectly. So there's a long way to go in this process. It's just a draft environmental impact statement. There will be public hearings that follow, and then the final environmental impact statement. I must say that the sort of local reaction was they had hoped to see something in the environmental impact statement that analyzed the benefits of keeping Eielson as it is, meaning in terms of access to training space. There was very little in the way of research in this EIS regarding what advantages exist to keeping things as they are. It was almost entirely focused on moving to Anchorage.
Well, it does seem from reading the material and hearing what people have to say who were involved in this that the Air Force has made up its mind, whatever the process may take, or at least has a favored course of action if it hasn't made up its mind, correct?
That's definitely true. The Air Force has made it pretty clear that this is what it wants to do, and this is, contending that this is the best way to proceed into the future. Of course, the state's political establishment has been pretty much unanimously against what the Air Force is saying and citing, strategic implications of operating out of this area. And also the possibility if you have a problem down in Anchorage, volcano goes off and air traffic is limited. This is sort of an alternate place out of which to fly out of. That's one of the things that was not even mentioned in this environmental impact statement.
Thank you. Dacia, the Attorney General admits the state made errors in handling alleged murderer Jerry Andrew Acker's previous court cases, his arrests, his sentences quite specifically. What did Attorney General Garrity have to say, Michael Garrity, and what are its implications?
Yeah, the Attorney General held a press conference in downtown Anchorage Thursday, and basically he said that going back to Mr. Active's first charges in 2007, you know, where he furnished alcohol to a minor in Togiak, which is actually a Class C felony there. He pleaded guilty in exchange for this suspended sentence, and he got 3 years of probation. And somehow that information, that Class C felony, never made it into APSIN, which stands for a bunch of words I can't remember right now.
It's an acronym, but it's a state information system.
Exactly. It's a database, and it should pull up someone's criminal history to look at us. They're, you know, you're considering what they'll be charged with. So he committed this next crime, which did involve sexual abuse of a minor, attempted sexual abuse of a minor. And when they pulled that up, they didn't see that Class C felony before. And so they gave him less time than they could have. You know, it's hard to say, going back, would they have given him more time or not? But they had the possibility of giving him more time, and they didn't, because they didn't see that. So that was the initial error. And then, you know, it sounds, you know, like he had a couple more brushes with the law. There were violations of his probation and, you know, drinking and so on and so forth. And he ended up in jail in Anchorage. And then, of course, you know, if you haven't heard about it yet, this terrible crime where he broke into
someone's
house.
It's one of the worst in recent memory, one of the worst murder, rape, criminal activities. And the guy had just gotten out of jail and got
that
across.
Day,
yeah,
he was released from jail. And also, the Attorney General pointed out that he did not like that Mr. Active was let out on a Saturday of a three-day weekend. And he wants to make sure that that never happens again, because Mr. Active should have checked in with a probation officer, but there was no one for him to check in with until Tuesday. So there were a few mistakes.
And you
made
have to wonder. I know that a released felon who's committed, you know, a crime and completed his penal time, he is released in the community and sent back to his point of origin, which in this place was not time was not Togiak. It was Anchorage. So he went across the street to live in the homeless shelter. And so people, you know, complain about the homeless shelter and say, well, look at the kind of people you have there. And they have a right to say, well, look at the kind of people you send us.
Right. And then also another thing that the Attorney General addressed was that folks like Mr. Active, who commit these terrible sexual assault crimes, often have had a terrible history themselves. We don't know what Mr. Active's history was, but they're supposed to receive options for treatment if they have, you know, had sexual abuse themselves happen to them. And, you know, he said everything is being reviewed. This APSIN system's being reviewed, the procedures for entering information into it, also releasing someone on a Saturday of a three-day weekend, that policy's being reviewed. And he said anything else, including the treatment for domestic violence and sexual assault offenders, is being reviewed.
And there's almost certainly one other shoe to fall here, and that is at some point there'll be a lawsuit, I would think, against the state. And quite a bit of the information, no doubt, would be in the suit.
I think you can bet on it.
Okay. Dermot, an important state review board adds billions to the state's estimate of the value of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Most of us know nothing at all about this process, or very little. Perhaps you can explain it to us and explain why this is of significance.
Okay, Mike, I'll give it a shot. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline is very important to the, in terms of a source of property tax revenue, to the North Slope Borough, the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and Valdez. In recent years, there's been a great deal of controversy and court fights over the value of the pipeline and associated facilities for property tax purposes. The latest ruling by the Department of Revenue put the value of the pipeline for 2013 at a little more than $7 billion. The oil companies had contended it should be around $2.3 billion. So there's a big gap there. But there's also within the Department of Revenue, something called the State Assessment Review Board, which meets every year to review the ruling by the Department of Revenue on the property tax assessment of the pipeline, how much it's worth. This board came back recently with a very striking and sort of critical report saying that the Department of Revenue is wrong, and the Department of Revenue has undervalued the pipeline by almost $5 billion. This state review board, which is headed by the former assessor of the municipality of Anchorage, Mr. McGee, said that the pipeline is worth more than $11 billion. So this is, as with almost every other year in recent memory, this is going to go to court. In fact, every year since about 2006, every year is still at either in Superior Court or Supreme Court in a case with the oil companies, the state, and the municipalities all saying that the pipeline is worth different amounts.
And how long does this process take? And is there interest attached if the amount is higher and the companies have to pay it?
In terms of how long it lasts, that's anybody's guess. Because I think since 2006, every year is still in either Superior Court or the Supreme Court. So this latest one may go on for several years more. The key point here is that for the municipalities, this provides them with key property tax revenue. In Fairbanks, for instance, it's kind of as a rule of thumb that if the assessment of the pipeline goes up by $1 billion, it's worth about $1 million extra in property tax revenues. So this is going to, and this money goes ahead and is spent by the municipalities. If it turns out in the end that the Alaska Supreme Court eventually rules that it's wrong, then they'll have to sort of make some financial adjustments.
But, and I assume both parties or both sides, or if they're more than three sides with different municipalities, more than two sides with different municipalities, would present rational arguments and a rational basis for these differing conclusions. Do you know enough technically to explain that to us?
No, I know enough to get myself in trouble about just about everything, Mike. So in this case, going back many years, for the first few decades of the pipeline's existence, its value went down just about every year. But starting about, you know, nearly a decade ago, they began valuing the pipeline to determine what it would cost to replace it. Now, if you look at the pipeline value that way, what it would cost to replace it, you're going to get much higher values. So the pipeline value has been accelerating in recent years, not going down. And so all three sides, the oil companies, the state, and the municipalities, present detailed research to back up their point of view about what it would cost to replace it, and also, perhaps very key to the state, what the life expectancy of the pipeline is in terms of the confirmed oil reserves on the North Slope. The municipalities have come in at the highest numbers. The state have somewhat lower numbers, and the oil companies are the lowest.
Okay. Sean, Athabascan elder and late-in-life activist Katie John is dead at age 97. We touched briefly on her achievements in the show last week, but you've been following her story this week, and the memorial service that was held here in Anchorage is another, I guess it's the burial service is going to be held at Mentasta.
Yeah, there's a memorial potluck.
This is
a
major story in Alaska, and especially in the Alaska Native community.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, what struck me most, of course, you know, she's probably most famous for the lawsuit that bears her name, the Katie John case, that was a fight over who should manage subsistence rights in navigable waters over on federal land. But she did a lot more than that. Katie John was instrumental in creating the first alphabet for her dialect, Otna dialect of the Athabascan language. And she was a teacher almost her whole life. She helped build the first school in Mentasta Lake. But what I find interesting is that you strip all that away and you have an Alaskan who witnessed the modernization of Alaska. She saw the first, it was talked about at a memorial here. She remembers her first airplane that she saw, the first car. One of the great joys she took, one of the big firsts for her was getting a perm. So she kind of saw, especially from a rural perspective, the way Alaska has changed for better or for worse in all of those areas. And we just seem to be losing a lot of those types of people, both native and non-native. And I think that you saw kind of an outpouring of that feeling at her memorial service. Interestingly, the big service is going to be tomorrow in Mentasta Lake at 1:00. Some of her family are estimating as many as 3,500 people could show up.
That might
up.
Be the most people that's ever been at that place.
Probably, and they've already been starting camping to just make sure they get a spot. So,
well, it's quite a moving story. Daisha, you've been reporting on Katie John too. What did you see?
Well, I went to the memorial service at the Baptist Temple in East Anchorage and talked with many of the people there who were related to her. She had 250 children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren.
Must be some great-greats in there as well.
There might be some great-greats too. And, you know, so it was very personal for a lot of them. one of the things that they remembered most about her was her hugs. She hugged everyone, and she always would make a meal for you. She was very loving and took care of her family, and that's what they remember about her. But I also ran into Bob Anderson, who was the attorney on the Katie John case in 1985, and he said, quote, "She's an important figure for the Upper Otna people, but she's really a part of the Alaska civil rights movement, not just Native rights, but civil rights. And she's a sweet, kind person, too." And he was kind of tearing up at that point. And everyone followed up, you know, yes, she was this amazing political figure, but she was this loving person. And she never got bitter. That was something that they covered in the memorial. They said, you know, her children were taken away from her and sent to boarding schools. You know, these terrible things that a lot of Alaska Natives went through. And she remained a loving, open, kind person.
Okay. Dermot, we'll go back to you, and we'll go with another resource question. Fairbanks is embroiled in the continuing debate over the future of natural gas brought to Fairbanks. The economics and regulatory issues are complex. Take us through them.
All right, Mike. Recently, Governor Sean Parnell signed a bill that basically sailed through the legislature in the end, creating really a $360 million financing package to liquefy natural gas on the North Slope and get it trucked to Fairbanks. Most of that money is in loans. There's about $57 million, I believe, in grants. But this is thought to be sort of the way of helping start to get Fairbanks to more of an economy that's based on cheaper natural gas than on high-priced fuel oil. It has a long way to go yet, and it's a the Alaska Industrial Development Authority and the Alaska Energy Authority are working on sort of trying to see if this can actually fly, if it's going to work. They hope to have something, deals arranged by this fall to see whether or not it would proceed, and then have a project actually in operation within a couple of years. Many people think that's a very ambitious schedule, and it's going to be tough to make it. But politically, there's probably a lot riding on this for the 2014 election in this area. The governor came here to sign the bill, and it's clear he's going to be campaigning on this over the next year. In the meantime, let's just say this differently. For more than half a century, people have talked about trying to get natural gas in Fairbanks and to try and lower the cost of living, and that's what's involved here. So you have, on one hand, the state trying to build this plant on the North Slope, and on the other hand, a distribution system. There's an attempt now to get a more expanded distribution system in place.
And there's some entities. There's some conflict over who's going to be the provider, right? Briefly.
Correct. There's a small company, Fairbanks Natural Gas, which has about 1,100 customers and has had, you know, for about the last 15 years, has been providing a small amount of natural gas service in Fairbanks. There's also a recently formed municipal gas authority that's trying to get off the ground. Both of those companies, entities, are before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska now seeking the ability, a certificate of public convenience and necessity, to serve the greater municipal area of Fairbanks.
Okay, we better leave it there. Sean, BP plans a major expansion in Alaska. There's disagreement about how many dollars actually will be involved in it. But this is of significance because it's happening, I mean, just in itself as an economic matter, but also politically because it comes right after the governor's oil bill passed and the governor, in effect, promised us this.
Yeah, I think it proves a point for both sides of that debate, actually, for those that thought the previous tax ACEs, Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share, was too onerous. It shows that the new tax system is more business friendly to oil companies. BP's now saying, Conoco has said they're going to invest. I think on the other side, though, it also, I think people can point out that the oil companies had obviously had these plans in place. These didn't just come out of the ether. And so they were waiting for a chance to put them in play when they would make more money. Bottom line is that this fight isn't over. As you know, there's a group mainly backed by the group Backbone that tried to keep the Senate majority intact that was preventing the governor's tax bill from passing. They have a signature gathering effort. We have a strong citizens initiative clause in this state, and they want to overturn the tax through citizens initiative. If they're successful, The legislature will be barred by statute from changing that for 2 years. So how much investment, when it's going to come, I think that that's...
Well, you can see this investment leading to advertising on the pro-Parnell side of, you know, smiling workmen banging on machinery saying, it's working, it's working.
But by some estimates, that's still not going to be enough. I mean, we're showing dwindling revenue even under the increased investment and potential increased production because of that investment. That could be as much as $4.6 billion by fiscal year 2019, less than we would have had under the old regime of ACEs, you know, and they oil is going to be between $109 and $118.
Dermot, we have less than a minute, and I want to talk about one thing, a little change-up for you, because we don't have time for other topics. This Sunday, it will be Don Young's 80th birthday. He will have served half his life, 40 years, in the Congress of the United States. There are many people who don't like Don Young, but there are many people who do. That's why he keeps winning all those elections. Whatever you say, this is a remarkable achievement, isn't it?
Yes, well, I think when he first got elected 40 years ago, I think no one would have predicted this, you know, that he would stay that long or that he'd want to stay that long. But, you know, it sort of became his life, right? You don't hear him much. He hasn't complained in many decades about the professional politician, you know.
Since on that note, we will have to leave it right there. Thank you very much for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.